Okay, we'll call the meeting for Wednesday, April 5th, to order. We have a quorum. We have a bunch of recognitions and proclamations. So we have recognitions for employees. And I'll go through the list, and if the proper procedure, we'll bring them up and hand them the brochure. So if you're Michael Moon, you have 5 years with Lincoln County. Are you here? Naisa Chastain. Dolores Bennett.
Just stand right here.
Gail Bradshaw. He has 15 years, and so does Dolores Bennett. Jessica Bonley, 30 years.
Whoa.
It gets longer. Julie Stalkup.
Yay!
You have 30 years. And John Waffenschmidt.
Congratulations.
Yay.
With 30 years, so.
Let me get in front of here.
You're not working. Thank you. Over here, take the stack apart. Congratulations. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Get up here.
Five more years until you get in.
Okay. You got to get a deal picture. Get in there.
Here?
Yeah.
Retire when Julia does.
Hey, you can stay here longer.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And thank all of the employees that we've listed, and in fact, all of our employees that. The longevity in this county is excellent. We have a lot of employees that have been here a long time because they do such a great job. We have new hires, and so do you want to bring up your new hires?
We don't bite.
We'll just stand over there, and I'll just give you the inquisition. I'm Terry Thompson, County Commissioner, and Bill Hall and Doug Hunt, and we do this to try to get to know that we're here and we're people you can call on if there's something that needs to be brought to our attention. We'd be happy to have you come in. So would you introduce yourself and kind of where you're from?
I'm Sandy Kirk. I moved down from Alaska, and I'm working for probation and parole as a technician at the new transitional center.
Where at in Alaska?
I spent over 40 years in Ketchikan, but when I came here, I'd been in Wasilla for 3 months.
Oh, we hardly have any rain compared to there.
They asked me about the rain. I said, no.
Don't be a problem.
We don't like you guys.
Where are you from?
Chris Wilson. I'm from Arkansas originally. Worked for adult mental health, and health human services.
Long ways from home. Your other home. Hope this you'll make this your new home.
This is home.
I'm Teresa Campina. I'm originally from California, but Oregon's been my home for about 25 years now. And I came from working at OSU Foundation.
Wow.
Jacob Hostetter. I actually moved here from Pennsylvania. I work in the Health and Human Services, Adult Mental Health.
Thank you.
Yeah, great.
Welcome to all of you.
Yeah.
Good.
You can introduce yourself, too.
Oh, I'm good. Dental Cruise personnel.
Great. She's over here all the time. Welcome to Lincoln County, and I hope you enjoy working here.
Look forward to seeing you again.
Okay, we're down to resolutions. And Bill, who's handling this one?
I'll have Bill read the first one, I'll take the second one.
Okay, sounds fair to me. Let's invite our presenters to come up while I'm reading. Proclaiming April 3rd through 9th, 2017 as National Public Health Week in Lincoln County. Whereas, National Public Health Week is an annual observance during the first week of April that recognizes the value of public health in protecting and improving the well-being of individuals and communities. And whereas, the U.S. ranks 34th globally for life expectancy, we have set a goal for creating the healthiest nation by 2030. This will require a commitment at all levels of government to strengthen the public health infrastructure and invest in the root causes of poor health. And whereas, while the medical care system focuses primarily on treating people after they are ill or injured, the public health departments try to keep people from getting sick in the first place. And whereas the state of Oregon is in the process of modernizing our public health system to assure proper response to emerging diseases and that everyone, regardless of income, race, or education level, has the opportunity for good health. And whereas public health focuses on prevention by providing home visits for every new parent and baby and educating adults and children about the dangers of drugs and tobacco use. And whereas public health promotes healthy behaviors such as vaccinating children, encouraging safe sex behaviors, eating healthy foods, and getting daily physical exercise. And whereas public health protects everyone in Lincoln County by controlling communicable diseases like norovirus outbreaks in our schools and assuring that restaurants are complying with Oregon laws so people don't get sick when eating out. And whereas Lincoln County Public Health is committed to promoting healthy lifestyles, preventing disease and injury, and assuring safe delivery of quality health care for all Lincoln County residents. Now, therefore, we, the Lincoln County Board of Commissioners, do hereby proclaim April 3rd through 9th as National Public Health Week in Lincoln County and encourage all citizens to support Lincoln County Public Health in their efforts to achieve the goal of becoming the healthiest nation by 2030. Good morning.
Good morning. Yes. Thank you so much for reading that. We tried to make it a little bit more local and kind of explain in the process of proclaiming this Public Health Week what exactly public health does in our community. So,
and we all know you, Rebecca, but for the audience,
Sure. I'm Rebecca Austin. I'm the Lincoln County Public Health Director. So this is Public Health Week. This is a national week that is proclaimed, and I believe you proclaim it such every year. And it's just an opportunity for us to raise awareness, not only for our local public health authority, which is all you, but for the community as well about exactly what public health does. And I think the one takeaway from the proclamation is that we do a lot, and that we really do try to focus on population-based health. It's not individual health care. So we try to get policies passed that make the healthy choice the easy choice. And one of our successes has been to get a no-smoking policy passed for all of Newport Parks. They already have it in Lincoln City, and hopefully one day we'll get the county to do the same. But it's really important to dissuade young people, especially from smoking, to not have them see people smoking and enjoying themselves when they're in our parks. So that's a very typical public health approach to things. And we use evidence-based research to guide our practice. And That's what I wanted to say, and I appreciate your support, and I appreciate you helping us to raise awareness about what
public
health does.
You're not getting out of here that easy.
What? Bring it on, Terry.
Okay, you're the expert. What do you see as the biggest problem now? Because this is pretty presumptuous that you're going to raise this nation to the healthiest nation in the world in 13 years. What's the biggest challenge to accomplish?
Well, you know, last time I was here, I think we were still pushing for the healthiest nation in 2020. So you see what we do is we just move it up 10 years and we're getting close. What do I see the biggest problem or the biggest challenge? The biggest challenge, I still think in our community the biggest challenge is tobacco. And, you know, we're up against the tobacco industry, who spends millions and millions of dollars every year on enticing new tobacco users, which is our kids from, you know, 6 years old all the way up. And they're making tobacco more appealing to kids. They're flavoring it. They're putting the ads lower so that kids can see it. They're packaging it more glitzy. They look like little fancy cell phones now, and you know, it's just every time we think we've got a leg up on them, they come out with, you know, e-cigarettes, you know, even sexier looking than just a pack of cigarettes. So everything looks like candy. And, we, you know, once you're hooked on nicotine, it's very difficult to get off of it. So I think that's our number one challenge. And it proves in the data that our population suffers from tobacco-related diseases the most.
So how would you compare that to overeating?
To overeating? You mean as a problem?
Well, lack of physical exercise, yeah. And overeating.
Yeah, well, I would say that's the next problem is getting the word out, and you have supported us in trying to get some resources together and a plan put together that we can have a healthy nutrition and physical exercise program for in our county, which will get us to have lots of partners at the hospitals, at the schools, community-based organizations, the county, different businesses that will do some workplace wellness programs, you know, and really start encouraging people to eat healthy. And it is happening. It's happening across the country. More and more people are aware. We've kind of stopped the obesity rate from continuing to grow among our kids. It's kind of leveling out, so now we just need to start seeing it dip down. And that is happening. Packaged food sales are down. People don't want to buy that packaged food anymore because they know it's not as healthy as real food, whole foods.
Bill, so, you got to brag.
Oh, you're talking about my weight loss?
I'm talking about your weight loss and your change in health in the last couple of years, 2 years.
Yeah, well.
You should be your poster boy.
Well, I'm down about 125, 130 pounds from a few years ago, and I had my lowest weight since I came to the county 30 years ago, but still got a ways to go, but with eating less, eating better, and walking a lot. I mean, mm-hmm. It's the one thing, you know, I think everybody's got to find something they enjoy, and, you know, since I don't have any real athletic skills to speak of, I figure putting one foot in front of the other is not too hard, and the Fitbit, you know, for me, you know, some people love them, some people say it doesn't make a difference, but I call this my little electronic nag, and mm-hmm. when I get the little buzz that tells me I've hit 10,000 steps, 5 miles in a day, it's like, yeah, all right, a definite sense of accomplishment, so.
Yeah, and one of the things that public health really tries to look at is what is our environment friendly for mm-hmm. people to go out and walk? Is it safe for people to go out and walk? So those are the things that we're going to be working on for sure in the next year. Yeah. You can count on it.
Well, I guess a couple of thoughts. First of all, to clarify, the county does have a policy against smoking in buildings. Parks is not a part of that policy, so we've at least taken an initial step toward addressing the smoking. And I think that I'm interested in your comments or your thoughts generally. Healthcare has gone from a treatment aspect to a preventative aspect. You talk about nutrition and obesity. Are there other areas where we've made some significant strides
in preventing disease, you mean?
Well, the change in attitude.
Ooh, you're putting me on the spot here.
I guess what I'm asking for in a general sense then is when we talk about the cost, the idea through wellness and preventative is to prevent the behavior that costs high expenses in the long run. Can
right.
you elaborate on that?
Well, that's a big part of what public health does, is that we are trying to prevent disease and prevent injury. I like to think of ourselves as kind of the backup to public safety. You know, our law enforcement protects us against crime, and we try to protect against disease and injury. So, because that's where all the money is invested in health care. You know, 90-some percent of our health care dollars are invested in taking care of people after they're sick. And what really public health is trying to raise awareness about is that if you invested a little bit more money further upstream, as they say, before those diseases happen, then we'll save a lot of money. That's how we're going to really cut costs for healthcare. And so, you know, 68% of Lincoln County residents live with at least one chronic disease. That's a huge number. That's a huge dollar number attached to that. And it's why we can't become healthier, I think, is because when you're living with a chronic disease, you don't feel that good, you know. And so when somebody asks you how many days out of the month have you not felt your best, those numbers are going to be higher in Lincoln County, because when you have a chronic disease, you don't feel your best.
I have one last comment, and I'll let Commissioner Hall. You talk about change in lifestyles. I know my kids, they don't live at home anymore, but for many years, they've always complained because when I pull into the parking lot, whether it's a grocery store or Freddy's, or I always park in the first parking spot I find and go, Dad, we got to walk all that way to the door. And I go,
my gosh.
Yeah. Exercise is good for me. So I think that's an example of something that you can do that, you walk a few extra steps.
Exactly. It's a little thing. So if you're in the city, and take the stairs instead of the elevator and things like that. Yeah.
Well, just one observation I wanted to make is I think Lincoln County Public Health and other Oregon public health programs are really accomplishing a lot with very modest resources. I mean, I think we still rank, don't we, in the bottom five of all states for spending on public health.
Yes, which that's right.
I think is a real shame. You know, at one of my education days in Salem that I attended recently, I met a retired doctor who said, you know, maybe the legislature ought to have a third chamber, a House, a Senate, and then maybe a third chamber just really devoted to looking at the long-term outlook. Because I empathize with, like, what our legislators are wrestling with right now. You know, more than $1.5 billion budget shortfall. But it seems like when we're in constant crisis, like we often are, you know, that these things that you maybe don't see the initial payoff, but you do see a huge payoff down the road, that these get bumped to the bottom of the priority list, which is a shame. And, you know, one thing I'll mention on tobacco that I think a good thing hopefully coming out of this legislature, and I did some public and behind the scenes lobbying to help move it forward, is for raise the legal age for purchasing tobacco products to 21. That has passed the Oregon Senate now, still has to be approved by the House and signed by the governor, but I think that's a positive step. Mm-hmm. But, you know, and then anytime something like that happens, you'll always hear the naysayers saying, oh, the nanny state again. But, you know, when you look at the fact, what percentage of our population, you know, is dependent on government-funded health care, whether you think Medicare, Medicaid, active duty and retired military, government employees at the state, local, federal level? Mm-hmm. That's a huge burden directly on all of us who are paying taxes.
Exactly.
Plus the economic burden when folks aren't at their peak health, they're not as, you know, I mean, I think we ought to be worried first and foremost about their quality of life, but also recognize the fact that they're not as productive economically if they can't be at their peak when they're at work. So I think we do have a big public stake in helping people achieve the greatest level of health they can achieve. So always glad to help in any way I can, and I know the same goes for these guys.
Yes, well, we appreciate it so much.
Mm-hmm. Yep. You have our support.
Thank you.
I like the idea. When I ran for office, and man, you're running for state representative, I wouldn't take a dime from the. I'd let every lobbyist know if they had a tobacco company. Don't mix it in with the funds that came to me, and I'd like to see that done by more politicians throughout the state.
Absolutely. Yep. Yeah. Great. Well, thank you.
I thought it was interesting when you talked about the addictiveness of nicotine. I saw some of the audience members nodding their head affirmatively, so that's pretty strong evidence.
Yeah.
So, thank you for coming. Good luck.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I hope you can make your goal.
Yeah, well, we'll see.
Without moving it again.
I'll move for approval of the resolution proclaiming April 3rd through 9th, 2017 as National Public Health Week in Lincoln County.
I'll second that.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion passes.
So, second resolution.
I'll read that. Proclaiming April 2nd through 8th, 2017 as National Crime Victims Rights Week in Lincoln County. Whereas Americans are the victims of more than 20 million crimes each year, and crime can touch the lives of anyone regardless of age, national origin, race, creed, religion, gender, sexual orientation, immigration, or economic status, and whereas many victims face challenges in finding appropriate services, including victims with disabilities, young victims of color, deaf and hard of hearing victims, LGBTQ victims, tribal victims, elder victims, victims with mental illness, immigrant victims, teen victims, victims with limited English proficiency, and others, and whereas providing victims with knowledge of their rights and available services further strengthens their ability to recover by restoring a sense of self-empowerment, and whereas a trauma-forced response to victims promotes healing and fosters strength in survivors, a trauma-informed response. I knew that didn't make sense. A trauma-informed response to victims promotes healing and fosters strength in survivors. And whereas unaddressed trauma from victimization weakens the resilience of victims and their communities, impeding their ability to withstand future trauma. And whereas victims who feel understood and supported are more likely to disclose their victimization, seek services, and participate in the justice process. And whereas a multidisciplinary response involving collaboration among victim service professionals, criminal justice officials, legal professionals, medical and mental health providers, and community leaders is essential to reach and serve all victims, especially those who are marginalized, have disabilities, or live in remote locations. And whereas National Crime Victims Rights Week, April 2nd through 8th, 2017, provides an opportunity to recommit to ensuring that all victims of crime, especially those who are challenging to reach or serve, are afforded their rights and receive a trauma-informed response. And whereas Lincoln County is hereby dedicated to strengthening victims and survivors in the aftermath of crime, building resistance in our communities and our victim responders, and working for justice for all victims and survivors. Now, therefore, we, the Lincoln County Board of Commissioners, do hereby proclaim the week of April 2 through 8, 2017, as National Crime Victims Rights Week in Lincoln County, and affirm this county's commitment to creating a victim service and criminal justice response that assists all victims of crime during Crime Victims Rights Week and throughout the year, and to express our sincere gratitude and appreciation for those community members, victim service providers, and criminal justice professionals who are committed to improving our response to all victims of crime so that they may find relevant assistance, support, justice, and peace.
You want to come forward? So you're going to talk on it? This sounds like this was written by a bunch of lawyers.
I'll tell you.
Come on.
Last paragraph.
They're all hiding in the back row. Okay. One or the other, you come up here. Okay. Now, don't leave her up here by herself with me. Okay, that's the proclamation. Talk to us about what you do.
So I'm Jill Wagner. I'm the Administrative Chief for the District Attorney's Office, and also a certified victim advocate for the office. And I have...
I'm Susie Baer. I'm a victim's advocate for the DA's office. I handle domestic violence cases.
And we serve, along with ladies in the back row, the crime victims of Lincoln County.
I think a lot of the public doesn't understand what your office does. So give me a personal idea about what you accomplish in that office.
So we are tasked with making sure that we inform crime victims of their rights, ensuring that those rights are met in the criminal justice system, and that their voice is heard.
You do a lot more than that, so I'm going to have to fudge.
That's the nutshell of what we do.
You literally, on every case where there's a crime victim, you contact them, is that correct?
Correct.
You set up the court cases a lot of times. You
right.
have to review. It takes a tremendous amount of time when you think of all the cases that go through Lincoln County.
Yeah.
Susie, you got any
comments? We are their liaison between them and the whole criminal justice system. We find answers for them. We're there with them in court. We help them ask for restitution. We link them up with community partners, resources, if they need anything. We're their new best friend while they go through a pretty complicated, chewy, and often demoralizing process, trying not to re-victimize them, if you will. It's daunting to be a victim of crime, especially a personal crime, and we just hold our hand through it.
So, how very often do you find somebody that is knowledgeable about the criminal system that hasn't been there? I mean, my experience is I don't even know the procedures you have to go through, and there's a lot of procedures.
Yeah, the lack of awareness for the criminal justice system is seen daily by the victim advocates especially, because most people don't choose to walk this life of the criminal justice system and know each step that goes through. And it's just that, the criminal justice system. The person that has committed the crime has more rights than victims. And Oregon, being a leading state in crime victims' rights, has led the way to making sure that the victims have a voice in the criminal justice process.
Any questions?
No, just glad to have a chance to salute this important work.
So at what point do you become involved, I guess, for lack of a better word? I mean, there can be a crime or an incident, and does there have to be a case that's actually been created or filed for you to become involved? What's the process and what's the timing?
It has to be a reported crime.
Right. We get a probable cause affidavit on our desk in the morning for anyone arrested the night before. Or let's say a case opens up, someone's arrested, and the DA in charge, the DDA in charge, determines what charges are going to be brought. Once a case is opened in our office, we make a contact immediately. As soon as it's open, as soon as we in our office get the flag that we've got a new case, we contact the victim immediately.
Okay.
We do have some. There's two of us that are rape victim advocates that respond when a case is reported of a sexual assault. It's reported, it just hasn't come to our office yet. We do have a few people that respond to those.
So then can we... Oh, go ahead, Doug.
I was just going to say, so I know the Children's Advocacy Center, do you work with them? Or, I mean, obviously that's children, but I assume you would work with a crime victim regardless of age, which your resolution says.
So we have many agency partners that we work collaboratively with. So we, by statute, we have responsibilities as a DA's system-based victim advocate center. So we're the ones that have to make sure that they're notified of every single court proceeding, make sure that they know that they have the right to be there. And then we have our partner agencies that also assist in those, such as a sister's place, the Children's Advocacy Center, and it's a collaborative effort to make sure that we help crime victims.
So my question is where's your funding come from? It isn't all based out of counties. Where's your funding come to maintain this department?
Grants. VOCA is our main funder. And then we have CFA.
You might want to clarify the acronyms.
Yeah. I'm trying to remember what CFA stands for.
Sorry.
It's okay. So we have the federally funded. The violence
against
we don't have any VAWA, so we only have VOCA funds, and then we have CFA, which is state funds that primarily fund our entire victims department.
And if I understand right, you're mandated by state law to exist, and
yes,
there is a possibility of funding cuts under the present administration.
Correct. Actually, that we have watching very closely at the VOCA funding because we have projections of it being cut.
Wayne, I'm going to ask you a question.
All right, I'm going to take a picture while you're asking. Go ahead.
Okay. Boca funds being cut is going to be a problem for them. What happens in a system where you have a law that says you have to do it, and then all of a sudden you don't have money?
Well, we face this all the time. There's actually legislation on the state level that talks about what's called unfunded mandates, and you're aware of that. And that's something we struggle with perennially. And that's the idea that there are laws passed and then no funds provided to enforce those laws or deal with those laws. So we fall into a larger discussion about what do we do and how do we do it with the limited amount of funding that's made available to us.
We are very fortunate, and I would like to take the opportunity to thank you, because we did get Susie's position funded by the county, so she is our only advocate that is county-funded. The rest are all grant-funded.
You know, this is going to be a difficult thing we may have to wrestle with down the road, given the state's budget hole and given the talk in Washington. I mean, it's still early, and one of the oldest sayings around Washington is the president proposes and Congress disposes. But, you know, I mean, I hate to think that we may be in a situation. Bill Bain, a former Newport mayor, active in a lot of civic affairs, and he was Lane County's assessor in the early 1980s when their budget just really crashed due to the crash in the timber industry, and he said when they had to lay off, I think, more than one quarter of their staff all at once in the assessor's office, he sat down with the county council and they said, okay, let's look at our mandated functions. Some of these we're mandated to do, and there's a clear penalty spelled out if we don't carry them out. Others say we're mandated to do it, but there's no penalty if we don't. So that was how they prioritized their service cuts, and I hope we never end up in that kind of situation, but we could.
Susie, you may wind up with a whole lot of work to do.
Let's hope not.
So I think we should make note, Commissioner Thompson, does not your wife work as a crime victims advocate?
Well, that's why I know a little more about this.
And well, I should recognize her efforts in that area, too.
She's, I guess, the head of the victims department, per se.
She's our supervisor for our victims department, yes.
Yeah, and so I hear about this stuff, and I wanted to pull out some of the questions that I think may develop here in the near future, and I think it's important because you do supply such an essential service, because most people have no idea, because they're all of a sudden they're a victim and no idea about how to proceed in the process. Thank you very much for your time and the resolution.
Okay, I would like to move that we adopt this resolution proclaiming April 2nd through 8th as National Crime Victims Rights Week in Lincoln County.
I'll second it.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Motion passes. Okay. Under, looks like we're going down to consent. Oh, yeah, we're going to the consent calendar item.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we're moving to the adoption of the consent calendar. Consent calendar items are routine nature, or we've previously heard. Is there anything you'd like to highlight or delete?
Nope, Mr. Chair, I'd move for adoption of the consent calendar as presented.
And I'll second it.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Motion passes. We move down again to public hearings. The legalization of East 23rd Drive in Lincoln City.
Commissioners, if I might, this is a continuation of a public hearing that you've held previously on a couple of occasions. So the first item would be to reopen the hearing.
Okay, I'll reopen the hearing on East 23rd Drive in Lincoln City.
And you would ask staff to get some additional information, and I know that one of the parties that's owns property abutting the legalization, who's participating in the previous hearing, has some additional information too. So I think the first order would be to get that information from staff.
Good morning. I'm Roy Kenyon, Lincoln County Public Works Director. And we did have a fairly substantial audience, but I guess nobody was interested in the rest of the story. As Wayne said, this is the continuation of the attempt to legalize Southeast 23rd Street in Lincoln City. And at towards the end of our last gathering, there was some questions come up regarding what if there was a reduction in the 60-foot right-of-way? How would that affect the utilities? How would that affect the city of Lincoln City, who isn't a player at this time? But looking forward into the future, we do believe at some point in time, Southeast 23rd will most likely become a city street. As Lincoln City grows, they will basically engulf this area. And it is one of the few industrial areas in Lincoln City, and so it's going to be developed out. And that's what Mr. Phillips is trying to do, is further develop this area. And because of his need to clarify where the right-of-way exists, it brings us to this point. I had conversations with all of the utilities involved, plus the city of Lincoln City. And generally speaking, there weren't a lot of issues other than with CenturyLink, who is the communication provider in the area. They right now exist roughly 10, 11 feet in areas just to the north of the paved surface. And they just wanted to make sure that if the right-of-way was moved, and if they actually were somehow then located outside of the right-of-way, that they were granted either an easement to exist on what would then be the private property, or that the property owner basically provided some way to move them back into the right-of-way. Northwest Natural Gas, they say they're located on the south side of, immediately south of the paved surface, and that no matter really what happens here, they won't be affected really in any way. Pacific Power, basically their poles are kind of scattered in and out of the right-of-way, but there again, they just wanted to be sure that if they have a pole that is currently located within the right-of-way, if somehow that pole finds itself outside the right-of-way, that there is accommodations to make sure that they have an easement for the pole to exist where it's at. City of Lincoln City, we basically asked them if Southeast 23rd Street was to become a city street, what would they require for right-of-way? And they said that they would be fine with 50-foot. They said that they basically prefer to locate their utilities, which would be water and sewer, down the center of the road. And so to them, right-of-way width really wasn't an issue as long as they had 50 feet. As far as Lincoln County Road Department is concerned, we have really just one drainage facility in the area. It's a cross culvert with a standpipe catch basin. The catch basin itself is located roughly 15 feet from the center of the existing road. We do, from time to time, maintain the ditches that run into it in the catch basin area. And so we want to make sure that we have the room to continue to maintain the facility as long as it's still Lincoln County Road. And so I guess that brings us to, you know, my recommendation. I have no issues with the 50-foot width on the right-of-way. I do believe that center of the road is traveled should be center of the right-of-way as legalized. I know there's been some conversation about shifting the right-of-way one way or the other to where maybe you would have 20 feet on one side of center line, 30 feet on the other, which still fulfills your 50-foot width but shifts the right-of-way to the south. And I just warn that as far as I know, Lincoln County has not done this kind of a side shift in any of our legalizations, and that if that was to be granted in this case, I think it would set the precedence and we would open up a can of worms for all of our legalizations going forward. that each individual property owner can come in and request that we do a side shift left or a side shift right in front of their property. And I don't believe that's really would be attainable. We actually have another legalization coming up sometime in the near future, Ocean View Drive in Yahats. And that is a road that is right on the coastline. It is heavily populated, very dense housing. And I would really hate to see, you know, half of those people come up with a similar request asking for the right-of-way width to be shifted one way or the other.
John Waffenschmidt, County Surveyor. Just to follow a little bit further on the line of thought that Roy just spoke to, we advise citizens all the time about the location of county roads in relationship to their property. And one of the tenets of our advice to them is you can measure from the center line of the traveled way and roughly determine where your property and the public's rights to the county road begin. And if we get into where we're not following the center of the traveled way with a stated width or half width, that makes that advice almost impossible to give. And it also impedes those people's ability to go forward. We allow private land surveyors to simply take the record width of a county road and monument that themselves. And then should we go back in and try and legalize that location, we try and hold their monumentation of that county road based upon the traveled way center line. So when we talk about shifting right-of-ways and having a different width on one half of the center line and a different width on the other half of the center line, it's going to make us very difficult for us to advise citizens in the future and allow them to proceed without any formal action from the county.
Commissioners, if I might just note another element of this particular request, because we did have some conversations with the representative of the property owner on the west side of this. You may recall there's a 30-foot where it abuts the 101. There's a
right.
Yeah. West, am I right?
Yes.
On the west end of the area that was proposed to be legalized, there's only an existing 30-foot right-of-way there, and we were looking to legalize that. And there had been a great deal of discussion around the improvements of 101 there and where that road might intersect with the county road there. And there still is a desire to leave open those options on that end, although I do want to state for the record, and I'm not sure that I want to make sure to hit the record here, that at the time that we were discussing that, back when ODOT was doing their improvements to 101, the county made it eminently clear that any costs associated with relocating the intersection of 23rd with 101 would have to be borne by the property owners there. There would be a requirement for some additional dedication of right-of-way in that area. However, I don't think that issue needs to be resolved at this point. And so we are going to, at least our recommendation, and please correct me, guys, if I'm wrong with this, is that we back away from doing the legalization of the western portion of this and just legalize that portion that starts with the 60-foot right-of-way to whatever width you would actually agree to and go to the east there, and that we not at this time do the legalization. It leaves open that option for actually making that the improvements in the location of the road coincide with whatever development occurs on the west end. And so we don't have a problem with removing that portion from the area that would be legalized. But I do want to make it clear for the record, so sometime in the future when this comes up, that the county is not paying for the cost of the relocation. That's going to be borne by the property owner.
Okay. Anything else? If not, is there anyone else who'd like to talk, testify on this?
Yeah. Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Dennis Bartoldis. I am an attorney representing Mike Phillips. Mike Phillips is also here. He'd like to make a few comments. What I'd like to do is just kind of clarify the information that Mr. Phillips has gathered to submit into the record in support of a narrower width. I think you've got this letter from the City of Lincoln City that said they would be fine with a 50-foot right-of-way. Also, a letter that went to you from Pacific Power in indicating they didn't have any issues with a lesser right-of-way. Also, CenturyLink had written a letter, and I think you've got a copy of it. It said that our utility will not need more than 10 feet from the north edge of the pavement and therefore have no objection to a shift of the right-of-way area in this area to the south. There's also letters that we just received very recently that I provided this morning. One was from Devil's Lake indicating they didn't feel a need for more than a 30-foot right-of-way. And then Geddes Paving, Mr. Geddes is the owner of the property just south of the Phillips property across the roadway, and he indicated that he had no problem with a shift of the right-of-way. So it would be 20 feet on the north edge or north of center and 30 feet on the south of center. So we submitted all those since when we met in January. He asked us to go out and get some information that showed that these groups would support something less than a 60-foot right-of-way. As you're aware, this area is in your the Lincoln City Urban Growth Boundary, so planning-wise, this is intended to be in the city of Lincoln City within the foreseeable future. We support the narrower right-of-way of 50 feet. The one area where we would have probably a difference with the county is being able to shift at least in front of the Phillips property, and quite candidly, that's primarily what I'm concerned about, is a shift of the right-of-way further south in that area for this reason. When you look at the topography in that area, the Phillips property is level, generally speaking, except on the west end, there's an area where it goes up. That area is level and is usable pretty much up to the road. The Geddes property, on the other hand, goes up an embankment, and the usable property on that property, which is already developed, is above that, and it's a little bit further to the south. So the natural taper through there would suggest that you could accommodate a curve in a right-of-way that was shifted slightly to the south. As to the situation involving precedents and that type of thing, I think the county looks at these on a case-by-case basis. This is a road that originally was not built where it was described to be built. It was, there was testimony before. This has been a situation that people have been aware of that's existed for 70-plus years. It's obviously caused some confusion by not having it legalized in the past. It's not uncommon throughout the county, whether it's a county road, whether it's a public road, that they're not always located perfectly in the middle of the right-of-way. There's a lot of county roads where they're not in the area where they were originally described. That's true of public roads. Public roads, if you just look at the GIS maps that the county has, whether the planning department or the assessor's office, while those are not perfectly surveyed, you can look at the location of the roads through there, and you'll often see that they're off to one side or the other, or sometimes maybe not within the right-of-way in some areas at all. So, generally speaking, if the county wants to preserve the right-of-way in an equal distance on a 50-foot right-of-way, candidly, we don't care about the rest of the roadway. We're concerned about the Phillips property. Mr. Phillips has an immediate plan to develop the property to further the tax base, to provide an area for industry up there, which is sorely lacking in Lincoln City. And so he would like the shift at least in front of his property. I don't see that it's going to cause any problem. All the property owners in that area are aware of it. And legally speaking, I don't think this causes any precedent that you have to deal with, because each of these are viewed on a case-by-case basis. And I know Mike has a few things he'd like to say.
Yeah, I'm Mike Phillips, the owner of the property in question. And after the last meeting we had here, conversation, I left with the perception that shifting the road was an option if we got, approval from the utilities and neighboring property owners. So before I started on that, I was the one that went to the city and asked if we could reduce, if they would be interested in having a conversation about reducing the right-of-way so that I wouldn't have to go to my neighbors and say, hey, we're going to shift this to the south and you're going to lose 10 feet of land. Which in reality they wouldn't lose 10 feet because it would still would have fallen within the original deeded right-of-way that nobody acknowledges. So the city said, sure. You know, we would probably be happy with 40 feet. And I said, well, 50 feet would not change anything to my neighbors on the south from what has been proposed. And, you know, it allows me to shift my property line, not shift it, reduce the impact of the right-of-way to me. So they were the ones that I was the one that started the 50-foot proposal. They got on board with that. And as I would like to note, they would have been happy with the 40-foot right-of-way. So the shifting thing is okay with the city, with my neighbors. You know, keeping the road in the right-of-way, the road in the center of the right-of-way doesn't do me a lot of good. Every time you guys want to, or the road department wants to do something, it kind of impacts me, and I'm trying to, you know, minimize that impact. That's the whole goal of this. So the other thing is the phone company was the first utility that I talked to, because they're the ones that are on my property. And when I talked to them, they said no problem with shifting the right of way. They also said that if they had to move the lines, as Roy mentioned, Mr. Kenyon mentioned, it kind of wanders and drifts out of what I hope will be the new right-of-way. They would not have a problem at their own expense moving it back into the right-of-way. They deal with these problems all the time. So I did offer to pay for that, and they said, you know, because they have to deal with it all the time, they typically take care of it. So that's all I had.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Ask Mr. Belmont a question.
Do we go out of the public hearing at this point?
Well, received all the public input you want now we can close the hearing.
Is there anyone else that would like to testify on this?
Make sure you have somebody else here.
First, I guess. Close the public hearing.
Now, Mr. Belmont, just a historical question, and if you could help my memory. I seem to recall one case where I thought we did agree to a similar request for a right-of-way shift in a legalization process to keep from impacting a private home.
There is a provision under law, and it's 368.221, that talks about you can do a lesser width to avoid an encroachment, an existing developed encroachment, and that's what we did in that particular circumstance. And that's because you actually, this process is similar to doing, if you legalize and there is an encroachment there, there's a possibility you'd have to pay compensation for the encroachment. And so that is a tool that's provided to you to actually avoid that. In that case, I think we jogged out a couple of feet to avoid an encroachment from a building that had been there for a number of years, an existing encroachment. But to my knowledge, that's the only time that I'm aware that we've shifted.
And that's really not applicable in this situation.
No, because it's not developed.
It's not developed. It's not an encroachment.
But if we did want to do the shift, is there a legal, do you see it as legally permissible or not?
What the statute says is that you have, if you find it's in the public interest, you can do a legalization less than the width described in under the statute, which would be the 60-foot, the normal width. Mm-hmm.
Well, the procedure then is...
You have your deliberations. Have your discussions.
How would you like to proceed?
Well, I'll
always get looked at first.
If you'd like me to go first.
You're on the right, I'm right in. It's okay. I'll go first. I think the recommendation of staff makes a lot of sense. I'm perfectly happy to compromise and reduce the deeded 60-foot... right away to 50, but I do have concerns about setting a precedence and having future requests to start burying the center line, and it just creates I think a lot of potential confusion, unintended consequences in the future. So I'm comfortable compromising with a 50-foot right away, but I think we should maintain the center line.
Well, I'm in favor of the 50-foot right-of-way, but I am in favor of the move here, because as requested by Mr. Phillips, because, I mean, look, we've got no issues from any of the adjacent property owners.
Can I note, for the record, I want to make it clear, because I think there's actually more than the property owners. I don't think we have all of them that have given a letter. At least I was looking. There was at least another.
But the directly impacted ones.
There's
right?
No. There's two that are to the south of this who have, we haven't received anything from.
Oh, okay.
No, there's only. There's actually only one other. There's Ray Clark.
And I thought there was.
No, Devil's Lake Rock is the one, and you have their a letter from.
And then Geddes. We have Geddes, and but there's at least one other property owner who is adjacent to that we do not have a letter from.
But to me, just personally, what tips it in favor of saying yes is this is within Lincoln City's urban growth boundary. It will be in the city at some point, maybe sooner, maybe later. And if the city says it's fine with this, you know, I think industrial land throughout the county is at a premium, and especially in Lincoln City, and anything we can do to facilitate development, I think development of industrial land is in the public interest, and we can find that unlike, you know, certain cases where it would only benefit a few people, I mean, this is... to me, supporting economic development and growth in Lincoln City, if we make this what seems to me to be a rather modest accommodation. So I guess you're the swing vote, sir.
Well, this, I'm going to look at you both. I mean, the question should go to Roy, but I'll ask it to Wayne. The precedence part of this that Roy is talking about, how critical is the precedence part of it?
Well, in a sense that do we get requests continually along roads, you know, to say we want to develop without going through a process of legalizing and where can we build to? We get these all the time. I mean, I have to let these guys talk about the number of requests you get. But I know that this is not the first time we've had this issue come up.
Well, and this isn't going to prohibit economic development or job creation either. So,
but in those cases where these requests come, is this going to affect any of those?
I think that probably would, you know, I'll have to leave it to these guys to answer how they're going to provide advice to people when they come forward, but it'll make it more difficult now when you come through to say, look, if you want to develop tomorrow, you want to get a building permit from the planning department, if you want to be on the safe side, you go to the center line and go out X amount of feet. We know there, the center line and developed area. That's been the traditional advice since I've been here. Now we'll have to say, well, no, there's an opportunity to change everything, and then the question will be, do you move it 10 feet this direction, 10 feet that direction? The people on the right, as Roy said, the people on the left get this. So it'll make the situation much more difficult for us to be giving advice to people, short of saying, you're going to have to legalize every time one of these requests comes through if you want certainty to it.
That's what we do.
I know. That's fine. In this case, you asked for legalization, but now we'll basically, we've actually had numerous developments occur without the legalization. People have gotten permits and developed without the legalization, relying on the fact that they've looked at center line plus the number of feet to that side. And it's your call, it's a policy call. You do what you want to do. But
well, I'm trying to look at the long-term consequences of this. At this point, Bill, I'm looking at that and would probably support Doug's proposal on this one, where we stand today, because of my working with the planning department and with the road department and knowing that the challenges they have, I don't want to murky the water any worse than it already is. So, Wayne, do we go to a vote now?
Or? Well, what you need to do is give us a consensus. And I think there's several elements to this particular request right now. First of all, the way it initially came through was 30 feet on the western portion of the road to be legalized. And the recommendation that's coming from staff is that you not legalize that portion of the road. So we would start with the area that begins with what had been the 60-foot right-of-way and move east to the end of the road.
In agreement on that.
Is there a consensus on that to do that?
Yes.
Yep.
All right. And then the second question would be, is there a consensus to reduce the right-of-way width, as you can do under 368-221, to 50 feet from what had been historically 60 feet?
I'm okay with that, but I have a question. This is in effect, if we have a right-of-way, I know we don't own the land, but it is land that we as county or as a public entity have some rights to.
Absolutely.
If we give up that 10 feet, what are there compensation issues that can be raised? We just...
Now, you have the right to reduce the red, the width. Okay. You can reduce the width.
All right. So I'm okay going to 50.
That's 50. Mm-hmm. So then the third question is, do you? I guess you got two options here. One would be to move that 50 feet as requested by Mr. Phillips and his attorney, or to move it from the central line of the improved surface 25 feet on each side. If there's a consensus to do that, then what we would need to do is we go back and actually have to redo the survey on this, obviously, to reflect that, and then get a new legal description on that, and then come back for you for a final order to adopt as a legalized area.
Well, I'm in favor of the option to maintain the center line throughout the easement.
25 feet on each side.
Yeah.
And I'm in the minority on this one, but you've got the two votes needed.
Okay, I think that gives us the direction that we need, and we'll go back and prepare then a final order with the appropriate survey. There's a variety of things we have to do under statute to actually establish this.
Okay.
All right.
All right. Do you understand what's... Is there any questions about this? If not, Wayne,
well,
we'll give you the written information.
I guess there's... Really no questions. You know, obviously we're disappointed on that situation on the 25 feet because, I think what Mr. Belmont was talking about was a different situation. That's a situation where people are coming in, don't want to go through the legalization process. Mr. Phillips has spent expensive, a lot of time and money and everything to go through this process to do it right. He didn't build a building before he legalized it, even though he probably could have gone out there and said, I'm going to go build my buildings right. And let the county challenge me. He went through the process, and I think it's an apples and oranges comparison.
I think there's a compromise here. I think we've accomplished some compromise. Historically, I don't give up any right-of-ways from the county, and this time we decrease some. So
I would agree.
And we've tried to be somewhat compromising in this. And I'm sorry I didn't do everything you wanted, but hopefully we've accomplished that. Okay.
We gave up 10 feet.
Okay. So, thank you. We move down to supplemental order for the proposed People's Utility District converting the existing Southwest Lincoln County Water District to a PUD.
Commissioners, as you may recall, adopted an order to form the district, actually to form the conversion of the Southwest Lincoln County Water District to a People's Utility District.
Just a second. Anna, will you go outside in the hall there?
And this is being placed on the ballot for voters to decide in May 17th, 2017 election. Mm-hmm. One of the requirements of the formation process was that the Oregon Department of Energy hold a hearing on this matter because it does involve a PUD, and this particular proposed PUD actually lies within the boundaries of an existing PUD, which is Central Lincoln PUD. The hearing was held. No issues were raised, and the main reason is because Central Lincoln PUD is not in the business of doing water and has no intention of the business of doing water. Southwest Lincoln County PUD, if formed, will be in the business of water and has no interest in the business of generating electricity. So that was fine. That worked. We've received their report as required by law. That report needs to be incorporated, and we would address any issues if there were any. None were presented. So this supplemental order simply incorporates that Department of Energy report into the formal record.
Okay.
Pretty straightforward.
Mr. Chair, I move we approve this supplemental order for the proposed People's Utility District, PUD, converting the existing Southwest Lincoln County Water District to a PUD.
I'll second it.
And all those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Motion passes. We move down to reports. We'll go to commissioners' reports. Any reports?
Let's see. You and I were both in Salem yesterday. I went over there first for Rural Oregon Day, sponsored by several both state and private groups interested in economic issues for rural Oregon. And Lincoln County was well represented with the Lincoln City Chamber of Commerce, Oregon Coast Economic Development Alliance, and RAIN. So that was nice to see. We had some
one.
Who did I forget?
The Sled's Tribe was there.
Oh, the Sled's Tribe was there as well. Okay. I don't think they were an exhibitor.
Yeah, they were.
Okay.
They won an award for their edition up there.
Well, that's great. Yeah, yeah. So Lincoln County very well represented, and good welcoming remarks from the governor, acknowledging the health of rural Oregon and the health of urban Oregon are really interdependent. So I think it was a worthwhile day. And then you and I both testified together on one piece of legislation, and I know you were there for other legislation as well. The one we both offered testimony on, certainly a feel-good measure, but I think it's important anyway, observing a resolution observing the 50th anniversary of the Beach Bill. And, you know, we heard, I think, that open beaches are, you know, certainly important to the people of Oregon, but important for our economy along the coast. They said, depending on the source you listen to, we have 21 or 23 million visitors to the Oregon coast a year. And that, of course, no doubt will increase because of the eclipse this year. But, you know, it was an interesting thought, which I'd never really considered. Would we have such a thriving tourist industry if we didn't have almost universal access to the beaches?
Well, I guess I'll build off that. I was there for a Coast Guard helicopter build, asking that we keep the helicopter here in Lincoln County because of the change in administration. I decided to drop the bill, and Arnie and David and Gomberg and Surfrider was there, and we all testified on it. And then we moved down through the Capitol with all of us together in one band, and Bill will join us. And I heard the lobbyists say, "Uh-oh, the coast is here in mass."
Well, that's a good.
Yes.
Good for them to notice.
Yes, indeed.
So, and then of course, the Beach Bill is critical to all coastal counties. And with David Brock Smith joining us, we went through that one, and all of them seem to be passing. One has to wait for a work session. The helicopter bill, but I'm sure it's good. So we have had a lot of success on these kinds of things. And none of the bills that we're pushing right now cost a lot of money.
Helps.
Yes, yeah. Because I understand the situation of the legislature. It's hard to get money when there isn't much.
Well, yeah, and if I could, Mr. Chair, while we're on the subject of potential budget cuts at the state and federal levels, I was glad to see a news release in our inbox from Senators Wyden and Merkley that they were signers along with several other senators to a letter calling for Sea Grant not to be defunded. You know, it's such a huge presence here in Lincoln County, but one thing I really didn't realize is that it has some presence in 33 of the 50 states, and that was good congressional sign on to that letter. So, you know, we won't let these things go without a fight.
Well,
I think that's the message we need to get out to people.
I think it's part of our job. We have now NOAA here, Sea Grant, all these federal agents that have federal funds that are coming to Lincoln County and making this a healthier, stronger economy here. And as a county, a lot of these agencies can't directly come up and lobby.
Right.
But they're a part of Lincoln County, and I think we're totally within our role to ask that their funding be extended to these agencies for our own well-being, as well as believing that the agencies that we have here are extremely good at what they do and have a nationwide importance that we can be a role.
Well, could I share? I'm sorry. I know we want to give Commissioner Hunt a chance here, but on the theme of budgets,
you guys are doing fine.
One area where our advocacy has made a difference already. You may recall, I think it was Measure 98 that allocated 1.5% of lottery money to veteran services in Oregon. And although it wasn't in the measure itself, in the voter's pamphlet statement that the state submitted for it, It explicitly stated that this would be new money. It would not supplant existing general fund money. And that measure passed, I think, by 83% yes vote. Well, the governor's recommended budget actually called for backing out half the general fund contribution to veteran services and replacing it with lottery money. The very first thing I got through AOC as president was a resolution calling on full funding of veteran services, keeping faith with the voters. A lot of other veterans groups got into advocacy on that as well. And last week, Governor Brown reduced course and said she would now support maintaining existing general fund money on top of the new lottery money. And so I saw Cameron Smith, the director of the Veterans Department for the state, in the Capitol yesterday, and he said, thank you, Bill. Thank you, AOC. And now that the governor has come on board with this, that gives him the license, which he didn't have before now, to advocate with the legislators to make sure they keep faith with the voters on that one as well.
Well, I just thought I'd follow up on your comments about funding for these programs that are critical to our area, Sea Grant, NOAA, the Coast Guard, and I thought it was noteworthy at Schrader's Town Hall last Saturday, which I think about 400 people attended. Mm-hmm. It was a good turnout. But he made the observation, and I think it's an important one, that we need to remember that we're not alone. It's not just Oregon that benefits. And I think that was a comment you made earlier, Commissioner Hall, that there are a lot of these different programs and organizations throughout the country. And so not only do we need to be active, but we want to be sure that these other areas, representatives of these other areas, are active in supporting the funding of these programs. And I think that, it gives me a little bit more hope, if you will, that the funding for these programs has additional support or more support than we may realize outside of the borders of Oregon. So comment on that. And last thing I'd like to do is, I think this is the first time I've had a chance to publicly thank Commissioner Thompson for leading the testimony in support of the maritime sector bill last week when I was out of state. And I understand that bill has been moved out of committee and is now on the floor for consideration and has, I believe, broad base of support. So look forward to that passing. And critical step in trying to promote education and job training programs in the maritime sector and create some great paying jobs for people out there.
So I'd like to repeat what I said. It's kind of unusual where you have state senator, a state representative, two commissioners, and moving in mass in the hallways, and it's a good feeling. I mean, mm-hmm. It means that we're all on the same page, and then like I said, David Brock Smith came from Curry County, so that we're not just talking about for us, we're talking about for other counties and these kinds of issues. We've got another one, though, that directly comes up with us here on the 10th, and that's PMEC, Pacific Marine Energy Center, which is one that you've worked on, and you both worked on, and so the 10th, I'm supposed to testify on that one. It doesn't have quite the statewide significance at this point, but I'm sure it will if things, we get good education. In fact, this one could have worldwide significance. Excuse me. Beyond that, the session's moving forward. People are starting to get long faces, so you know you're getting making progress over there. Okay. Is there anything else that needs to be brought forward? Constituent input? I see no constituent input.
Remember what we're doing today is we're recessing this meeting, and we'll reconvene at 2:30 mm-hmm. To receive, actually, it's the discussion of, where is that out
here? The Oregon Fuel Action Plan.
Yes, thank mm-hmm. you. The Oregon Fuel Action, there it is, the Oregon Fuel
we'll
Action
Plan. Recess that, but I have one more question. The progress on setting up a conference call.
I saw it on our calendars this morning.
Yeah, I think we're working on that. Yeah.
Tanya, will you come up here and explain what's going on so we all understand?
So the meeting has been scheduled for April 27th at noon.
Okay.
With Congressman Schrader.
And that'll be just with the three county commissioners?
in a direct conversation. We have so many different interests that we want to talk about directly with representatives in Washington, D.C. We may try to set up other meetings in the future, but it's open to the public, but there'll be no public testimony. It's going to be direct conversations between us and Kurt Schrader and his staff, if everything goes together right, and understand that his schedule is difficult to make at this point. And so we're noticing that for a public hearing. Is that correct?
Public meeting.
Public meeting. Okay. Yeah. With that, we'll postpone till
recess
till 2:30.
Okay. You know that 4 out of 5 House D's have now signed on as co-sponsors.
Action plan. And are you doing this?
Commissioner, I'm going to do an introduction, but I apologize. Our two presenters from Department of Energy and Department of Geology are en route.
You know, you would think that the Department of Energy and the Department of Geology would understand how long it is and how difficult it is to get to the Oregon coast.
This time, Commissioner, I fully agree with you.
Okay, sit down. Let's go.
Okay, well, thank you, first of all, for allowing us this time and extending your
Meeting,
thank you, yes. So the reason why we're here today, this is a follow-up from our Cascadia Rising after-action report that I gave to you a few weeks ago. Our number one priority was an emergency fuel action plan. When we went through our 4 days of exercise for the Cascadia subduction zone earthquake back in June, it became very apparent that one of our primary resources, fuel, was going to be in short supply. Nor did we feel like we had a strong level of confidence that a state resource request to the Office of Oregon Emergency Management would be able to be fulfilled at the timeline that we would like it to be. That's pretty much been found to be a true statement, not just by us as Lincoln County, but all of our other counties and state agencies and our federal partners as well. We will all be very dependent on the resource fuel line for fuel. Deanna Henry and Yume Wong, who are going to be here in just a few moments, will be able to provide to you a presentation on what the outlook and assumptions are at the state and federal level for our fuel supply line, and then reactivating those systems through other transportation routes and delivery systems after a catastrophic earthquake event. In the time that we're waiting for those ladies to arrive, a couple of things I'd like to point out to you about our leaning forward. As we move forward with our after-action plan and developing plans, some of the components that we need to take into consideration for our emergency fuel action plan would be, starting in our main section would be the concept of operations. We need to have pre-planning and prioritization of who would get the fuel and when and under what circumstances. Figuring out what the damage assessment process would look like, and that needs assessment pre and during an event. And then how would requesting outside assistance actually work? We know we put in our resource request through the Office of Oregon Emergency Management, but there's actually a different process when you're requesting fuel. So making sure that our cities, our federal partners, our local state partners, our tribal jurisdictions here in Lincoln County actually have the right forms and the right information. So as they're requesting that up through county resources and then to the state level, we're not backtracking and asking for information we should have had at the onset. Another one is fuel points of distribution. We have community points of distribution, and we're getting ready to go through those again. We actually are very lucky to have an OSU intern that's going to be joining us for about a 4-month period of time. But the fuel points of distribution, we haven't really sat down and identified where are the most strategic locations, where are the easy access, because the majority of our fuel initially is going to come by helicopter, and then most likely some will come through shipping vessels off of the ocean. Fuel salvage. What do we have in private retail fuel tanks that survive? Our marine industry that may have vessels that are no longer viable that will have fuel in their holdings that might be able to utilize. Even vehicles or other pieces of equipment that may be damaged but still have fuel. How do we go through that salvage process? Now, most of those areas are in the city jurisdictions, and they, of course, would be responsible for salvaging their own fuel. But looking at this holistically from a county approach, we want to make sure that as we salvage fuel, that we still adhere to that prioritization that we predetermined before the event happens. Another one would be fuel transportation. At this time, it is our understanding for county emergency management that our initial fuel would come to us at one location for the county. Now, because we have Highway 18, 20, and 34, we may be fortunate enough to receive two fuel deliveries, one at a Lincoln City, basically 101 and Highway 18, and then again in Newport. But it would be the county and the city's responsibility to distribute those fuel resources based on our prioritization at a local level, but then determining how do you get the fuel from point A to point B, knowing your roads are severely damaged or may not be passable. It may require that we have additional helicopter resource requests in advance because we know we need fuel to go from here down to Yahats, ATV vehicle, four-wheel drive vehicle, back roads, maybe even using marine vessels to navigate over rivers where bridges have been damaged. So that entire transportation concept needs to be developed, thought ahead of time, and then agreed upon by a local policy group. Public information would be another one, letting the community know in advance what to expect. I think we still have a strong percentage of population that assume FEMA is there, the light is on, fuel will be coming, I will be able to use my propane barbecue to keep cooking, even though Northwest Natural Gas may not be available. Not necessarily so. We have to educate the public to have a true understanding of our limitations. Environmental waivers and consideration, and then coordination with all of our jurisdictional partners here locally in Lincoln County and then also at a state and federal level. So as we move forward, those are the planning concepts for Lincoln County that we need to have in place so that when a moderate or catastrophic event occurs, we've thought through these things in advance and we're collectively on the same page. So I believe our presenter has stepped into the room. Deanna, come on up. This is Deanna Henry from Department of Energy. She's going to provide our presentation for us today.
Hello, commissioners. Thank you for inviting me to come talk to you today about our Oregon Fuel Action Plan. Jenny has been working very hard on coordinating with the state to make sure that we kind of sync our two plans together. And today, I just wanted to tell you about what fuel allocation and fuel movement will look like in the aftermath of a catastrophic earthquake. But before I do that, I just want to tell you a little bit about our agency and our authorities, the federal and state structure that we work within, as well as what our normal fuel supply and distribution system looks like under normal circumstances, and then delve into the plan, and then talk about some key lessons learned that we learned from participating in two federal exercises this last year, which kind of helped us regroup, rethink, and better identify gaps and steps forward. So,
Billy, take over.
Sure. Please continue.
No problem. So, right off, in every declared emergency, the governor does have the authority to direct, control, and restrict the sale and use of fuel. And she does rely on our agency to have a plan that ensures that even in a worst-case emergency, we can get emergency fuel supplies to maintain emergency services, keep up our transportation corridors, our operation of our economy, and, of course, protecting public health and safety throughout the existing emergency. And so in every emergency in Oregon, we have 18 identified critical lifelines and services that should any of these be disrupted for any length of time, it could harm public health and safety, our region's economy, and even depending on its severity, our national security. So we are the lead agency. We share responsibilities with the Public Utility Commission on emergency support support function 12 was just one of the critical lifeline services. So we do take the lead on petroleum, nuclear, and liquefied natural gas emergencies, and the PUC takes the lead on electricity and natural gas. So our lead federal agency is the U.S. Department of Energy. So under normal circumstances like today, we're on a quarterly conference call schedule with USDOE and 14 other Western states to kind of monitor petroleum events of joint interest and of concern. But after emergencies like Hurricanes Sandy and Katrina, we are on a daily conference call with all 50 states in the U.S. Department of Energy so that we can assess what's going on petroleum-wise throughout the nation and anticipate problems closer to home from events from other regions. And what we've learned is that even though there's no actual supply issues from like Hurricane Sandy and Katrina, there are some perceived supply problems, which then results in behaviors like hoarding of fuel, topping off of tanks, price hikes, which those are the types of behaviors that our agency tracks and monitors because we can easily create our own supply issues when we behave out of the norm involving fuel because industry's just-in-time business strategy doesn't support those types of behaviors. Oregon is extremely vulnerable to a long-term or severe emergency because we do not have any refining capabilities. We do import 100% of the refined products that we use in the state. That's some 3 billion gallons of fuel each year. Now, the bulk of our supply, over 90%, come from four refineries located in the Puget Sound area of Washington State. And those refineries transport fuel to us via the Olympic Pipeline or by tanker ships, and all of that product enters into Oregon at the Port of Portland, where seven of our petroleum distribution terminals are located, and they are located all on liquefiable soils. We do receive a small amount of product from Salt Lake City, Utah refineries that kind of pipe product to a Pasco, Washington terminal, and then that product is trucked in to service some of our eastern Oregon communities. And then we also receive a very small amount of supply from California refineries. They pipe product up to a Chico, California terminal, and then that product is trucked to service some of our southern Oregon communities. But the bulk of our product does come into the Portland fuel hub, and once it reaches the fuel hub, two pipelines, one sending product to the Portland International Airport, and one sends product down to a Eugene, Oregon terminal. And then we have barge service on the Columbia River, as well as a fleet of about 1,500 tanker trucks to deliver product throughout Oregon to some 24 retail fueling outlets. And that's our normal supply system. It's very effective, but the problem is it does lack flexibility at all levels. Our refineries have been operating at near capacity for decades, so this means they do not have the ability to increase supply for any increase in demand. And at our Portland fuel hub, we have a six-day fueling cycle. So at any given time, we have less than a week's worth of supply. And then at the local retail level, depending on storage capacity, there's about a 2 to 3 day supply on reserve. And that's our system under normal circumstances. A challenge that we face, and Yumei Wang is here with us. She's with the Oregon Department of Geology and Mineral Industries. They did a study in 2013, and Dogami found that our major pipeline that provides the bulk of our product to the state was largely constructed in the 1960s. So that's when we didn't know a whole lot about Cascadia vulnerabilities, catastrophic earthquakes. So we anticipate widespread damage along that entire line after a catastrophic earthquake. So we will lose all the fuel in that pipeline. The Portland Fuel Hub tanks out of the tons of tanks in those tank farms. Only three are likely to survive. Those are three fuel tanks that was built after 2004 when the city of Portland started requiring that all new constructions, including tanks, take into consideration liquefaction concerns. But whether those three tanks will be operational after an earthquake remains to be seen. So, and then finally, Dogami's report showed that those three marine docks that are currently permitted to receive supply won't likely survive a moderate earthquake, let alone a catastrophic one. And our agency doesn't have any regulatory authority to require these companies to make any seismic upgrades to their pipeline systems, tank farms, or marine docks. But what we are responsible for is to be ready to respond to a catastrophic earthquake as if it were to happen tomorrow, and be prepared to address the infrastructure vulnerabilities with all of its current problems. So understanding that that's our responsibility, we've been working to develop the Oregon Fuel Action Plan, and that plan is in its final stages and going through our internal agency review right now. And what our plan basically does is identifies 9 priority actions that our agency will take to begin the recovery of the infrastructure after a catastrophic earthquake. And it identifies how we are going to work with industry to assess the damages, estimate repair timelines, and kind of better understand how long it's going to take that infrastructure to get back up to speed. And it will be months, if not longer. It also talks about how we're going to work with Jenny and all you folks to assess your fuel needs, and we're doing that right now. A lot of work has to be done beforehand because we may not be able to talk to each other well after the fact. So we're working to assess what your critical missions are, understanding the type of fuel use you're needing, and then understanding where you would want us to deliver that fuel to. So those are the kinds of things we're working with Jenny on, so with the work she's doing is very valuable. But a big responsibility of our agency is bringing a fuel source from outside of the region to support our ongoing emergency response needs, because we will lose our entire incoming supply. But all of our fuel plan talks about what we're going to really do in fuel allocation, and that is a huge responsibility because we have a lot of customers. The state has over 120 state agencies with varying degrees of emergency response duties. We have 36 counties, over 240 cities, and 9 federally recognized tribes. So if our agency were to receive fuel requests from each individual entity, we'd simply be overwhelmed. So we have developed a structure that we can actually manage and make sure that we don't lose anybody in that structure. So those who qualify, and I call them pre-approved users of emergency fuel, are the 18 ESF lead state agencies overseeing critical lifeline services at the state level, our 36 county emergency management agencies, and the 9 federally recognized tribes. But there are a lot of responsibilities and coordination that has to be done between us and our pre-approved priority users to make sure that this fuel allocation program will work. So we do have to understand what each sector, county, and tribe's critical functions are. We ask that you know a general understanding of the fuel needed to do those functions. And then with the counties, once we deliver our bulk fuel supplies to these fuel points that we're going to talk and coordinate with Jenny to pre-designate, then the county is responsible for having a distribution plan. How are you going to get that fuel from that fuel point to your emergency workers in the field and to your critical facilities? So those are all the things that we are currently now working on. And the more we can do beforehand, the better we off we are in recovering from such an event. And how quickly we can move fuel depends heavily on three sectors that are kind of beyond my control. So we're coordinating with the Department of Transportation. We have to have viable transportation corridors by air, water, rail, and others to move fuel after a catastrophic earthquake. We have to have the ability to communicate with you. I cannot be sending fuel to places where I haven't communicated and I don't know that there's somebody at the end receiving it. And then power. We have to have power to either dispense a fuel, offload fuel, move fuel. So power is very critical in the overall infrastructure as well. So those are our interdependencies. I wanted to give you just a snapshot of this is our agency internal organization. Allocating fuel will take everyone in our agency's support, and these are all the folks that we are reaching out to with our customers. So we did learn a lot from two federally funded exercises that we participated in this year. One was a U.S. Department of Energy sponsored exercise, and in Clear Path 4, we learned something very valuable. After a catastrophic event, there will be a national fuel task force that's convened at a very high level with the federal agencies and the corporate oil companies. They will be the ones coordinating how they're going to identify an alternate fuel source that they're going to bring into Portland to support our efforts. And when we sat in that fuel task force meeting, we activated it. It gave us a lot of confidence that at some point, we're going to have more fuel than we know what to do with. But initially, it's going to trickle in, so it's going to require us to be independent for, we're going to say 3 weeks, that's our planning basis, because even if fuel's coming into our state right away, it's not going to get out to the folks who need it for a while. So it'll come into the federal incident support base, and we'll talk more about that. But knowing that fuel's coming into the state, it allowed us to focus our energies in Cascadia Rising on what we're going to do with the fuel once it arrives. So we definitely want to continue exercising with the federal and military agencies to keep fleshing out our strategies, but we made a great start. So what we learned from these exercises was that initially, damage assessment, we always think we can pick up a phone and call folks and find out what's going on. We're not going to after a catastrophic earthquake, so we coordinate and work with the U.S. Department of Energy. We will be relying on them heavily initially to get us all the petroleum sector information so that we could provide it to all our stakeholders. And one of our initial actions is, even with the help of a national fuel task force, it will take days, weeks to get that fuel to you. So what we've done is we've created a fuel database. We've collected data from Oregon State Fire Marshal's Office, DEQ, Department of Agriculture. We've collected all their data and we've modified it so that we can pull out all the critical information that's required for fuel allocation. And we have that database by county, so we're going to provide that to Jenny, of all your above ground and underground fuel storage sites in the state, because that is your initial source of fuel for the first 3 weeks after a catastrophic earthquake. And the state has authority, the governor has authority to allow you to use the fuel that's in your jurisdictions to do your initial life-saving functions until we can bring a bulk fuel supply in from outside of the region to you. What we're trying to flesh out right now is, does the counties have your own authorities to do that work? Because when we walk through the exercise with Washington, Clackamas, and Marion counties, because these folks have received grants in the past and they have developed some more mature plans than some other counties, Washington County was very uncomfortable with the state saying you have the authority to go take fuel from like a Shell station. They said we're very comfortable in going to take fuel from our own county motor pools or a public works yards, but I feel uncomfortable going to like a Shell station or a BP and saying, hey, I have authority to purchase your fuel. I have priority with it. So we're working with the Department of Justice to see if we could do an executive order for each county to so you could feel more comfortable. But you might have your own authorities already, and if that's the case, you know, you can exercise your own authorities.
We have the agreement with some of the fish boats that have large quantities of fuel on board that we worked on a few years ago, and that gives those vessels that we have agreements with, we can get fuel off them, or we can put them in business of fuel transport.
Those are exactly the type of MOUs and contracts and agreements we encourage all counties to have. And if you are comfortable with those kinds of contracts and MOUs, that's great. We're just wondering at the state level, we can help you execute it faster if we had an executive order specifically giving counties authorities to do unleaded diesel and all types of fuels.
It would help us. I mean, it would be mostly diesel off of those vessels.
It's okay.
Most all diesel, but it would run our basic equipment that we need to do the work. But it would help us to have that, because we did it years ago and we did it on our own with just a little bit of funds. It would help if there was a little bit of effort, because to really do it properly, you'd have to go out and spend time in the fleet, and it would take quite a bit. We got quite a few volunteers, but we need time to go out and explain to people what they're doing.
Absolutely, and it sounds like with the agreement you have, you're well ahead of many counties who haven't had those types of agreements or even thought about making those type of agreements. So, yes, absolutely. We'll get that. We're working with DOJ on that, and they understand the importance of it, because even if you have some contracts, you may not have reached out to all the other stations and card locks or whatnot. So.
Could I ask a question?
Yes.
And for Mr. Belmont. I mean, my understanding when you've discussed our emergency powers in the past is that we could assert that authority in a time of emergency.
You can, but what that's been discussed here is you have that all in preparation, all outlined before the emergency.
Exactly, yeah, and having it backed up by a governor's executive order, I would think, would be extremely helpful. That's what I wanted to say, that if we go to a perhaps reluctant supplier, that we could say not only do we have a local ordinance, we also have a governor's executive order, a big boost. So
we actually signed agreements with the boats that we did. Unfortunately, one of the problems you wind up with, it doesn't make any difference what kind of business is, they change hands.
Yeah.
This kind of thing needs to be renewed. When I reviewed it not too long ago, that several of the boats had changed hands over time, and just like I'm sure with gas stations, they change hands. I see the signs on some of them change, seems like almost monthly.
That's the price.
Even at the Portland Fuel Hub, they are always changing, so we're always having to engage, and they're not likely going to tell you, oh, we change hands either.
Right.
So, yes, absolutely. Thank you.
Well, and I think also an important part of this is just the education. I mean, it's one thing for the county to go to a fisherman and say, hey, I got this governor's order. It's another for the fishermen, not the fishermen are ever uncooperative. But
yes, they are.
I gave you a straight line, Commissioner.
Think about it. I'm the easy guy.
But no, I mean, seriously, I think the more you promote the education and the awareness of these agreements, the better or the easier it is, and the more effectively they can be implemented or utilized when it's critical.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Jim, you have something you want to...
Since you're in the legal arena here, the county has a fuel site. I'm sure if this happens, we're going to do whatever we need to do. But the fact is that it's been a long time ago, but when the county buys fuel, it doesn't pay certain federal fuel taxes on certain fuels. I was told at that time that because of the federal law, even in an emergency, we couldn't pump the fuel into a non-public vehicle. So, like, say, a locally owned ambulance, privately owned ambulance, we would not be able to fuel them even in those circumstances. So what happens now, or has that issue been thought about? Has it been addressed? What happens on this fuel tax issue? Are we still bound by that, or has that been changed, or what's the story?
That's a very good question, and that is a part of a number of different waivers that we are working with DOJ on. We've identified 16 waivers. There are federal waivers, state waivers, and sometimes it's a combination of both. We've identified 16 of them that involves either fuel, moving of disaster relief commodities. So we're going through all that right now, because we do not want anything to impede someone's ability to get fuel if you are doing an emergency services after a catastrophic
earthquake. Exactly. I could see private contractors helping repair and clear our roads, that if they came to us and said, yeah, we're ready to go, but we have no fuel, we want to be able to fuel them up.
That's the kind of circumstance we ran into, Bill. Okay. And they told us, no, we couldn't do it.
Okay. What's your capacity up there, Jim?
There's 15,000 gallons of diesel, 15,000 gallons of gas in terms of the tank size. Yeah. They tried to operate. I think we're still really operating on the top half of the tank if we can. So.
Yeah. Well, we don't ever have any more than 14,000 gallons in either tank. BEQ cuts us off at 14,000. We basically try to order roughly around 5,000 gallons of each about every 2 weeks. So we are operating off the top of the tank. But depending on when things hit, you know, if we're expecting a delivery, we could be down as far as 6,000-7,000 gallons. If we actually have something happen right after we've topped off, then we're looking at 13,000+ in each tank.
So it's a question of timing.
Yeah, I was looking at 200,000 gallons, maybe more, in the fleet down here. Mm-hmm. So, I mean,
these are all such good questions and details, and I will be coordinating with Jenny to really identify everything you need. And when she takes a look at our 16 list of waivers that we are currently working on, and if one doesn't specifically address that, Jenny, you need to call that to my attention, and we add it on the list. And we're just going to keep building on it. Great. You know, there's all kinds of, you know, color dye on diesels, you know, additives. What do we do? We're going to be waiving all of those, because if there is fuel to be had, we are moving it and we're using it.
One of the things that we have here, and I brought it several times to Jenny, mm-hmm. is we have fuel, but it may not be perfect. If a vessel has salt water in it, we need here, specifically, mm-hmm. we need centrifuges. We have some available, but they may not be. They're on vessels and stuff. They may not be readily available. We need a centrifuge off, because I've watched more disasters for imperfect fuel showing up, and you start running your equipment, then you're really messed up.
Yes, absolutely. Those are all things to identify in resource requests ahead of time. And so, yeah, we can anticipate those kinds of needs. Yes, absolutely. So anyway, so your in-county stockpile is going to be, in our minds, what you'll be using and authorized to use until we can bring in those bulk fuel supplies. Recognizing that the Cascadia Rising exercise was the first 4 days after a catastrophic earthquake, it really wasn't realistic in what we all practice. We wanted to just test through the Oregon Fuel Action Plan, so we went ahead and just took advantage of all the federal and military resources that were in town. We just walked through well into our plan. It would never happen by the fourth day of a catastrophic earthquake, but wanted to show you what we did. And even with the federal government's new push strategy, where they're not going to wait for a state to cry out before they bring in resources, they're going to just start bringing in basic resources into the Redmond airport. That's where their incident support base will be. Fuel is not one of those basic commodities, so it does require a formal request from our agency. So we kind of walk through that during the exercise. And so what they were able to coordinate with us and talk through was, they brought in 450,000 gallons of fuel for the initial delivery to the Redmond airport, and then subsequently, every day after that, they were going to be delivering 250,000 gallons of fuel for our use. Now, where they pulled together those numbers, I'm not sure, but they felt confident, were coordinating with some of the corporate companies, was that they can deliver that level of product to Oregon at some point. And so that's what we played with. So once the product at the bulk fuel supplies arrived into the Redmond airport, we talked through moving it closer to the impact area to three state staging areas. And the three that was picked for this exercise was the Portland airport, the Salem airport, as well as the Medford airport. Eugene is also a staging area. The problem with that in our scenario was that they had an explosion there, so we had to write them off and bypass Eugene for that exercise. But anyway, from the state staging areas, we airlifted fuel bladders to 7 public works yards in the impacted areas, some along the coast, some a little inland. And, you know, what we learned through this exercise from the federal logistics teams was pick and designate fuel points of distribution that are already set up and wired to receive, store, and dispense of unleaded and diesel fuel. Not that you can't pick an airport as one of your fuel points, it's just make sure your airport has that capacity, or we'll have to order bladder trucks or other apparatus to make sure that we can support your fuel operations.
Can I ask you a question here? Our big problem here is transportation across the Newport Bridge. If that goes down, if it's an earthquake, the airport's on the south side and most of the equipment's on the north side. What do you got in mind?
Good question. Now, Jenny's going to be working on this piece. You got to look at your county and understand where your islands might be. We call them islands. So if you have a bridge you know that's going to go down and you know there's going to now be an island somewhere, anticipate that. And so when I'm going to coordinate with Jenny to pick fuel points of distribution, you're going to make sure in each one of your islands you've got those fuel points of distribution. An initial response will be an air response. So even if you have no road access, we're going to airlift things and drop them off. But eventually, we're always going to have to worry about recovery. Everything we do is towards recovery. So we're going to be coordinating with Jenny to identify your county's priority lifeline roads. And I'm going to talk a little bit further about that, because what we're always thinking about is how do we reconnect your county, your islands, and start. But you are going to probably have independent islands of operations initially, if that makes sense.
We know a lot about the problem. We're working on food supplies, too.
Yes, and I'll talk to you about coordination at the state level. We're trying to improve that, and we understand not only do you need fuel, you need food, water, medical supplies, and everything else. And just today, why we were late was UMay and I got stuck at a coastal hospital in Florence. We're also working with hospitals because we need the hospitals to be operational and viable as well. So, and they need fuel too, food, water, electricity. So
excuse me, before you go off that slide, just to clarify, are there 4 state staging areas, and the Eugene one is not identified in this slide because it was part of the exercise that was no longer functional. But are there more than 4?
There are. There is a draft that Oregon Emergency Management put out. It hasn't completely been vetted and validated, so it's still draft right now. So there's a state resiliency officer from the governor's office. He's pulled together a work group of state agencies. We've got to vet those. We're going to work with Dogami to make sure those points that we picked as state staging areas are going to be viable after an earthquake. So for this exercise, I'm just going to say, you know, just for exercise play, I think Oregon Emergency Management just kind of picks some spots on the map. So don't hold us to those just yet. Haven't been validated.
So what about ones closer to us?
I believe there are a number of them. Right offhand, I don't. I'll show you. I have a draft plan in here, and I'll show you what Oregon Emergency Management has as a draft.
Okay.
Take a look.
So I'm going to ask you another question. Who mans the station and makes the decisions? Because if there is more need than there is fuel, been around this situation several times on fish boats. Who gets it? Who's got friends that are in control of the... So how do you deal with it?
So you're talking about prioritizing fuel deliveries and needs. Now, that is going to be... the governor's disaster cabinet, and they activated it for the exercise. And so it's a governor's representative, secretary of state, and then all the state agency heads that oversee each of the critical lifeline services. They're only at the meet and greet level. Their job, ultimately, and mission is to establish priorities. Have they done that? No, they have not yet. And so what we're doing is we're building the infrastructure. Those decisions will have to come at a higher level. And then you have to remember, this is a multi-state event. And so there are going to be regional priorities as well as state priorities. And then you guys at the county level have to establish your county priorities, because what fuel we bring into your fuel pods, it may not be enough for you to do what you need to do at the local level. So everybody's going to be thinking, what are your priorities? There's not going to be any easy decisions.
Deanna, mm-hmm. If I might add, commissioners, one of the most critical things for you as a policy group to have in place is your pre-completed fuel resource request forms. What our goal is with the proposal I know that we've submitted to you for leaning forward with the development of our plan, each of our cities, the tribe, our local partners that are here, will have our assessment completed. We will have our resource request filled out in advance based on the size of the earthquake, so small, medium, and large. We will fill out those request forms. We will have copies here, both electronically and hard copy, ready to go at our jurisdictions at multiple sites for the county EOC for redundancy. But we will actually have those pre-filled resource requests already sitting at the Office of Oregon Emergency Management. And we will, of course, hope that they, too, will have some sort of a redundancy plan if they're unable to access their office. And then also with Department of Energy, because if they have fuel sitting there ready to go and the other 35 counties don't have their resource requests filled out and fuel is available to go, it is going to be first come, first served. They're not going to want the fuel to just sit there waiting for some paperwork. So that plan that I've introduced to you is one of the most critical things. But we have to do an assessment. We have to decide where we want the fuel to go. We have to decide what those security measures are going to look like, what skeleton crew is going to secure it, whether it's law enforcement, public works. How do we do that? That plan that I proposed to you takes care of all of those issues, and it will be a long planning process. This is not something that will be done in 3 months. It'll probably take us 12 months to 18 months to actually put together that detailed level of a plan. And working with Deanna, other than maybe some of the larger metro areas that maybe, you know, have full-time planners on board, we don't, that, you know, we may be one of the first counties of our size to sit down and actually think through, from scavenging and salvage to the pre-filled out forms to the F-pods to transportation. I don't know that anybody has proposed this level of detailed planning that I am submitting to you for our future sustainability.
I
guess
concur.
What we can do is faster than that.
I concur. I think Jenny is right on. The more organized, the more you have ready to go, it will be that. And I am so glad Jenny says we will have hard copies ahead of time. And in my plan, I want to know what your priority roads, because I have an appendix in my plan for all the counties. What do they have ready to go? And if I know where your roads are, that's what we're thinking recovery. We'll airlift first, but as soon as we can get roads back up, we're going to be delivering over land. So we just need planning and getting everything done ahead of time. And Jenny is, you know, one of the rock stars in our group, because she's very enthusiastic and organized. So I think you guys are sitting in a very good spot.
And, excellent.
Yeah, and in our, we're going to a statewide conference next week, and that's what I'm going to be presenting to the counties, is that, you know, I, at the very least, whether you have a planner or not, I need to know what your backup communications capabilities are and 24/7 contact, because I don't think we're going to be able to pick up a phone. So we need to know what your backup communications are. Going to need, again, the minute I know where your fuel pods are and your plan, if I can't talk to you, I still can send federal and military resources out to assess. They said those are their fuel points. Is it viable? Let's move it, you know. So those are the kinds of things we're trying to get everybody ready to do. So And Jenny's primed to do that. So, and here's our recovery. Here are the state lifeline routes. These are the ones that as soon as we can, we're going to move on to recovery of the state's lifeline routes. So the blue ones are their priority tier one routes. And so I want all the counties, wherever you're located, to make sure whatever the county priority routes are connects and links up with one of the major state priority lifeline routes, because that's how we're going to reconnect the communities. What we'll do with the state lifeline routes is, as soon as we're ready to do that, I'm going to send fuel trucks out with utility trucks, power, telecommunications crews, and public works crews to try to start reconnecting the state's lifeline routes and then connecting to the county lifeline routes. So that's what we talk through with ODOT, with the Public Utility Commission, and all the utilities, and those are the things that we learned, and that's going to be kind of our structure. And then this is what Marion County has done. Now, Marion County with the City of Salem has received many grants over the years. They've been able to slowly pull together some of their planning. Now, they have a map that breaks up their county into 9 islands, because that's how they're structured. They're a lot smaller, but they have 9 islands, so they have fuel pods in each one of their islands. I just don't have their broken up map. And then those, the red are their priority lifeline routes. They have 4 tiers, and I told them the state only needs to know what your tier one routes are. You may have multiple tiers of roads that you want to get back up to speed as well, but what I'm looking for is your must-have roads that will reconnect major, your hospitals, your 911 centers, all those critical facilities that you guys know but that's in your county. And so we're going to continue working with all the counties. And some of those counties are marked out in the big map. You know, many counties are working on their fuel plans, but I'm really interested in working with the 18 counties west of the Cascades first. And we know that everybody's starting to work on it, or at least thinking about working on it.
So I'm sorry, again, clarification between the dark red and the pink counties?
Oh, the dark red, I put the dark red in because that's that I pulled out Marion County and showed. Yeah, yes. Yes, so the pink counties are the ones that I have they've actively reached out to me and are beginning to work on their plans. The ones that I haven't really had direct communications with, now, only the west of the Cascades. You know, there are counties east of the Cascades that are interested in fuel planning, but because they're not going to be as impacted, you know, my priority is still the 18 counties at this point to get all your stuff done.
How much further along do we have to go before we turn pink?
Oh, did I mark you? Oh,
well,
this is the outdated PowerPoint. You are pink. Well, I'm pink. Sorry.
I hope they can keep up better than that.
That's why I asked my question. I thought, well, it sounds to me like we're doing what you're asking be done.
Jenny is so on it that I gave this presentation a while back, and I emailed it to her. And I have an updated one today, but she's already has it all the way up. But, yes, you are well into the pink.
All right. Okay. Good to know.
And you are on an updated one for my presentation next week. So, yes. Good catch.
Okay. You're talking about salvaging fuel. You don't pump fuel with just any kind of pump. You're going to need certain explosion proof pumps and so forth. Is there money in particular in the plan, or does the plan at least address the idea of pre-positioning those types of pumps? I mean, having them in Salem isn't going to do us any good. Where it's highly unlikely we're going to have power. So we need explosion-proof pumps that are going to operate off in a standard genset. Are they going to provide those? We should have them, obviously, sitting here in advance. What's the thought on that?
That answer, the simple answer is there are no plans, no additional funding, not through our agency, but there are a lot of things going on through the legislature right now. task force. Oregon Emergency Management is being tasked to do a number of things, and there are oversight committees kind of guiding their work. You know, they recently had a bill last year that was passed where they were giving grants to card locks and other fueling locations to have connections for generators. You know, I don't know how, if any of the counties were able ever to get access to any of those grants, which, you know, that's the problem when you give a pot of money and you want to get it out quickly without oversight, because none of ODOT didn't have any say over how that should have been administered. Our agency didn't have any say about how that should be administered. So now it's just such a slow process, and they're restructuring it so Oregon Emergency Management will have more oversight in how they allocate funds to do certain things.
So we have similar problems here, but what we've done in Lincoln County, which I think could be adapted to the state, is we create a pot of money. Mm-hmm. We create a simple form, and it's a match of 50%. That way, rather than give money away, the people who want it the most and are the most willing step forward and move the things forward. If you just create a pot of money and you give it away, it's a completely different scenario. So that's one of the reasons I think that we've been so successful in this county, is we're not doing it on our own. We're creating partnerships, and the most motivated people get the money and the funds.
I hear you, and I concur, and Jenny has appeared before the legislature and joined other counties in talking to the legislature about kind of the needs and where some of the weaknesses are. And it's slow, but hopefully there will be change. Yes. So there are other ways we're going to be bringing in fuel. We're going to look at all aspects. There is, at any given time, barges that transport product up and down the Columbia River. And so we can expect that after a catastrophic earthquake, some of those barges will be trapped upriver from all that debris in the Portland bridges and everything else. So we are going to leverage barges and use them to store, transport, dispense, offload fuel to support our emergency response efforts. You know, the big question there is, how many barges will be trapped upriver? What will be the access be? And with barges, we'll have to share that with Washington State, because we share the river, and they're going to need fuel as well. So those are kinds of things that there are a lot of details to work out. Rail also is probably from a Department of DHS report. They said rail might be the quickest way to bring fuel in and out of an impacted area, even the tracks. But, you know, access to the rail companies is going to have to be leveraged and dealt with at a higher level. Perhaps the fuel task force would be dealing with the railroad folks at a higher level. But there are rail cars going in and out of Portland, bringing in ethanol and other fuel products to the fuel hub. So we might be able to bring that closer into the impacted area. So a lot of consideration to the different ways of bringing in fuel, and we're going to look at everything. But this is the one I wanted to tell you guys about. And I know Jenny's been working with the military department, but there are maritime assets that we can all request in order, and maritime assets do take 10 to 30 days to arrive upon our requesting it. And it's going to be much bigger than fuel, because they can bring shelter, they can bring big equipment to set us portable fueling locations, restore power, build temporary ports. And it's not completely official, but Newport is Newport, Coos Bay, and Astoria are the three ports that the military is looking at as being whether your port will be survivable after earthquake or not, that's a location that they're going to build a temporary port, so to offload maritime assets that's going to come support an emergency. So you guys are sitting in a very good location. So whether you are a state staging area or not, you're going to be the one of the few ports that are going to be receiving all the disaster relief supplies.
And I would just like to add, Commissioners, I've given you a little bit of tentative information. So on July 31st, I'm working with the Oregon Military Department and the Naval Fleet. They will be here. They decided to choose the Yaquina Bay as their demonstration site. They'll be on their way to Seafair in Seattle. And so they will be stopping here on the 31st. They're going to do a demonstration for us in Yaquina Bay on the South Beach dock port thing. There you go. Anyway, so they'll be here. They're going to offload a large amount, pieces of equipment off of their amphibian device and take it there as a demonstration. Oregon Military Department, they may actually catch a ride from farther south and then actually offload that. So that also is part of the federal and the state after action report for Cascadia, and then demonstrating to us at the local level how those devices can be utilized for bringing supplies and resources on shore. So that's to me, in my opinion, as an emergency manager, is a great progression forward of having a more direct link with those federal assets.
What are those dates again?
The states?
Dates?
July 31st. We have a tentative July 31st.
Not July, I thought you said July 1st.
July 31st, yes. Okay. Tentative, unless something awful happens, they should come.
Did you check and see if that was a day? I'd hate to see the Navy get...
The Coast Guard can fish them out. If they have any problems, we have Coast Guard can fish them out.
We have a day, the halibut seasons or major fishing seasons, that facility is absolutely saturated with boats. I don't want to start a war.
There you go. Which this is great news for this area, because if you are going to be selected as a temporary port, during Hurricane Sandy, the federal government lifted the Jones Act, and they were able to allow foreign vessels to deliver 115 million gallons of fuel to the ports of New York and New Jersey. And that is certainly something we have in our plans to leverage and use, which means the bulk fuel supplies from foreign vessels, if we activate those, will be coming to either your port, Coos Bay, or Astoria as offloading bulk fuel supplies as well. So that is all around good news for this area. So,
just to clarify. Mm-hmm. So the military agencies are looking at one of those three ports along our coast?
Actually, all three.
Okay.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And we do, in Oregon, get priority over the maritime assets, because in the federal government's assessment, the ports in Washington State are just located in a way where they're going to be much more survivable than our coastal ports. And so they already know that. And so during the exercise, that was told to us. So, you know, the three ports that they just need to validate and confirm it. And I know the military's been doing a lot of that work. When they're official, then we'll go full force planning on it. But until I hear officially from the military, I'm just going to say those are the proposed ports right now. Mm-hmm.
But ideally, all three.
All three.
The final
order. You bet. You bet. Mm-hmm. But I think it says a lot that they picked your area as the demonstration area, because they were looking at all three and where should we do this demonstration, and they picked you guys. Yeah. So here is the waivers I was talking about. We did identify 16. The Department of Justice has now identified all the state agencies that need to weigh in on those 16 waivers to make sure that it works out. We'll continue to coordinate, and my ultimate goal is to do boilerplate waivers. And like Jenny, already have them in my queue so we could pass them out as we need them. And we will eliminate those delays. And then coordination, boy, the counties coordinate really well, but what we found out through Cascadia is the state agencies, we swim really well in our own lanes, but we're not really good about crossing over and looking at our neighbors. But what we found out is after a Cascadia, if I'm moving fuel and Department of Human Services is moving food and water and Oregon Health Authority is moving medical supplies, there's only so many places that we can send it to initially, and now we're all kind of coordinating together to understand where those points are. But understanding that fuel and food and water and medical supplies should probably be separate. You know, we don't want fuel right next to a shelter and having people getting access to that. So we're coordinating, and the state resiliency officer is really doing a good job pulling all together the state agencies to do that coordination. And that kind of wraps up and gives you a snapshot of what we're doing fuel-wise in the state. And you guys have great questions. Are there others that you'd like to ask me?
Not a question, but maybe just an observation. I think this is encouraging, and once again, it sounds like we're ahead of the curve, though there's still a lot of work to be done. It just underscores again for me that, you know, there's a lot of talk federally about a $1 trillion infrastructure program. Rebuilding, it usually is focused, the discussion is focused on bridges, highways, tunnels, which of course are very important. But I wish, from a resiliency standpoint, we'd get more of a focus on other vital things like pipelines and our power grid.
So, if you guys don't mind, and since if you have a few minutes yet.
Yes, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to open this up and see what the public's got to say, the people that are here that are experts on the ground, if you don't mind.
No, not at all.
Is there any questions from any of you that were to ask or you'd like to ask? Now's the time. Especially the Coast Guard, you have a fuel supply problem too.
Yes, Commissioner. We rely solely on local fuel. There are Coast Guard entities that do have a tank attached to their unit. We do not, so we rely on fuel at the marinas to fuel our assets. In addition to our asset location, our unit location, locally speaking, we're in a very, very bad spot. And in reality, pending worst case scenario, sir, we're looking at not having any capabilities locally.
So do you have fuel purifiers that you can use, centrifuges or anything, if you have contaminated fuel? Because since if you have boats that are working, you have a chance to get fuel off of another boat, but you want to make sure it's high-quality fuel. Do you have that available now?
No, Commissioner, we do not. We had a fuel issue in the past, and we had to have that contracted out.
Commissioner, NOAA has some of the similar problems that the Coast Guard does, but we, depending on which ships we have here on hand and their condition after the event, our ships usually have large fuel purifiers on board that could be put to work to purify whatever fuel is brought in. So anywhere between 50,000 gallons to several hundred thousand gallons would be potentially available depending on what ships were actually here in Newport at the time.
That's a huge asset.
Yep.
Timing is over.
Hey, Commissioner, I would just add, with the proposal we have for development of our Lincoln County Emergency Fuel Action Plan, part of that gap analysis will be, how do we go from point A to point B, and what resources do we need? So the conclusion of that planning, it would be my hope I can submit to you as a policy group for the county, for the individual cities, the tribe, and other partners. Here is the list of emergency resources or equipment that we need or should have in place. We probably can't get any grant funding to request those items unless we have the Emergency Fuel Action Plan. Having that plan in place and prioritizing what resources we want to purchase with grant funds means we will be much more, we'll be at a better place to be able to ask for those funds because we have a plan and we know how we want to put them to use.
I agree with you. Is there a chance that a mutual aid agreement could be, I mean, this is above your level, but it seems like there could be a mutual aid agreement between the Coast Guard and NOAA, because you're both federal agencies, and even though you're separate budgets, it seems like a creation of a mutual aid agreement that you, as an Oregon energy expert, could encourage between the two federal governments. I don't think there's one there now that I know of.
No.
Commissioner, not that I'm aware of. Of course, I can't speak intelligently on any specific policies, but it seems like a good opportunity for us to collaborate and work together. We are in a similar situation and pull from each other's capabilities and resources. You know, for example, we currently have a memorandum of understanding with local fire departments since our assets have firefighting capabilities. Yes, sir.
So can we anyway help create something like that?
You know, and as a federal, both NOAA and Coast Guard are federal agencies, and you know, I will talk to my USDOE counterpart because they may be at a better position to facilitate two federal agencies. And I also know that USDOE has always said to me, you know, I've always asked, are we responsible for providing fuel to the federal agencies operating in Oregon? And they said, no, we're not going to be taxing you on the federal agencies responding in Oregon. We will take care of our own. But, you know, ultimately, the pot of fuel will be used by whatever level of emergency responders there is, but just know that the U.S. Department of Energy understands that there are federal agencies in the state working.
Can we help you by creating a letter asking for something like that? Because sometimes agency staff levels can't do anything and they're not aware of the situation that's here in Newport. We have both agencies here. It seems like we possibly could be, and we will get... If it's okay with the commissioner, do you think it's a good idea?
I think so.
That we, Bill, would you put together a simple thing and send it to you?
Me, yeah.
And then
I will
bring
elevate
up the line
it.
So no one down below, and see if we can't stimulate at least the conversation between two separate federal agencies.
That sounds great.
And they will be included. Our federal and state partners that are here locally will be included as stakeholders in the development of our Emergency Fuel Action Plan. And one of those other outcomes may be, what other mutual aid agreements do we need among these stakeholders or others outside of this jurisdiction?
Perfect. Great.
So, I think it's also important to note that there are other, I guess, departments within the state that are addressing some aspects of this issue. I sit on the Area Commission on Transportation. I'm currently the chair. And it was nice to hear the governor recently talking about budgeting money to improve the infrastructure along Highway 101, because I've been advocating that when the event happens, the more we do to improve Highway 101, that's going to affect not only movement of necessary supplies within the county, but along the entire coast.
Yes.
It's nice to hear those words from the governor's office, and it's nice to hear the Department of Transportation also involved. So there continues to be improvement.
Yes.
Good. So one of the things we should mention is the governor plans to be here. Do you remember the date, Rob Van, I saw on the computer? Maybe you don't know about it?
No, actually don't. I'm not even going to look there. You've got one over on me.
Well, I got an email the other day, and I'll have
to
look.
Sure, I know.
Is it the energy? Is it for the energy?
You're right.
It was what Mark left.
Yeah. You're right. I
forward that on to Mark Phelan for energy.
But this is energy. And I realize it's there for a different purpose, but we can take advantage of that situation to highlight some of these things if we have questions in mind. I believe in creating as many problems as I can for the governor's staff.
I'll reinforce the message about the highways, too.
Good.
Not really. I've known Kate for a lot of years, and we've worked together on a lot of things, and she's excellent, and I'm just encouraged to see her here.
Great.
Okay. Thanks for a very informative presentation.
Good information.
Thank you for having me.
Sounds like Jenny now has something to do.
I can only implement this with your assistance, commissioners.
Let us know what we need to do.
You know I'm a big supporter. I think we all are.
I know we all are.
these kind of conversations are going to make things a lot better. Thank you.
Yep.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Looks like we are adjourned, unless there's any other thing. We'll adjourn the meeting.